Bibles, we're going to look at the reading that Aaron's going to bring to us, talk to us about in a moment. So it's, as in the yellow sheet, it's 1 Kings chapter 16 and verses 29 chapter 17 verse 1, which is on page 357 in the sort of seat Bibles. So, 1 Kings 16, verse 29. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel. And he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to arouse the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than did all the kings of Israel before him. In Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son, Abiram. And he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua, son of Nun. Now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years, except at my word."
Well, thank you very much for the invitation to come back to Crockin Hill. Recently I celebrated, I think that's the right word, my 45th birthday, and realized that I'm 29 years I've been a Christian. I came to know the Lord when I was 16 years of age. And just at that point in life, I think, when I was leaving school and heading out into the world of work, I was a 16-year-old motorbike man, and there was lots out there for me, and I had my eye on it, and then God reached down and saved me and changed me. And although not in full-time ministry now for a number of years, it's a joy, it's a real thrill, privilege to be able to attend other churches and fellowship with other Christians and minister God's word there as well. So I'm delighted to be here with you this morning. For well over 100 years, the Israelites lived under the reign of three kings: King Saul, King David, and King Solomon. These three rulers of the Jewish people, of course, were great and famous men in many ways, although not one of them was without sin or failure. At the end of Solomon's life, of course, you will know that a civil war broke out in the kingdom that had been united under God's anointed leadership. The strife grew in intensity. The nation became divided into a northern kingdom called Israel and a southern kingdom called Judah. The division, of course, remained until both kingdoms fell to foreign invaders and the Jewish people were led away into captivity. Now, from the beginning of that division until Israel's captivity, a period of over 200 years, the northern kingdom had 19 monarchs. And all of them were wicked. Can you imagine that? 19 national leaders in succession. 19 kings ruling back to back who did evil in the eyes of the Lord. That environment of evil prevailed, of course, in Israel, in the northern kingdom, until the Assyrians invaded in 722 BC. The southern kingdom, on the other hand, was under the leadership of 17 rulers for well over 300 years. 8 of these monarchs followed the Lord their God. But 9 of them were wicked men who did not serve or walk with God. The southern kingdom of Judah ended with the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC and the subsequent 70-year Babylonian captivity. And of course, it's into this dark and dire history of the Jewish nation, particularly to the northern kingdom, to Israel, that we come this morning. Let's get a little bit of a feel, if you like, as to how dark Israel had become. Think, for example, of Jeroboam, the first king over the northern kingdom after the split. He is significant not only for his position as the first monarch of that era, but because he was the king who deliberately planted the seeds of idolatry among the people of Israel. He was the guy who built 2 golden calves for the people of Israel to bow down to and worship. In fact, we read of him in 1 Kings chapter 13, if you want to turn back just a couple of pages there. 1 Kings 13 and verse 33 and 34. Even after this, Jeroboam did not change his evil ways, but once more appointed priests for the high places from all sorts of people. Anyone who wanted to become a priest, he consecrated for the high places. This was the sin of the house of Jeroboam that led to its downfall and to its destruction from the face of the earth. Now then, when he died, his son became king. And we read of him in 1 Kings chapter 15 and verse 25 and 26. If you want to turn over the page to that, we read, Nadab, son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel in the 2nd year of Asa, king of Judah. And he reigned over Israel for 2 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, walking in the ways of his father, and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit. Now then, Nadab only lasted 2 years. And then he was assassinated by Baasha, who became the next king. And we read of him in 1 Kings chapter 15 and verse 33 and 34. In the 3rd year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, son of Ahijah, became king of Israel in Tirzah. And he reigned for 24 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, walking in the ways of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit. After Baasha, Elah, his son, reigned for 2 years. He was murdered by Zimri, who lasted for 7 days, and then committed suicide by setting the palace on fire around him. And we read of him, so he died because of the sins he had committed, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord, walking in the ways of Jeroboam, and in the sin he had committed and had caused Israel to commit. And then Omri became king. And despite all the bloodshed and idolatry and all the wickedness of the previous kings, the writer still says here that Omri acted more wickedly than all who were before him. In 1 Kings chapter 16, verses 25 and 26, but Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord and sinned more than all those before him. He walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit, so that they provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their worthless idols. You see, bloodshed and assassinations, murders and mayhem, intrigue and immorality, conspiracy and deception, hatred and idolatry had prevailed for six uninterrupted dark decades in Israel's history. This reign of evil began in the heart of the one on the throne and poured down into the very core of the people of the land. And then, as if things just couldn't get any worse, they turned the throne over to Ahab, the man who married Jezebel. Look again at what we read of him in 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 29. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel. He reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he had built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. This was Israel's darkest hour. What is striking here in these verses is we are told that Ahab married Jezebel. We're not told that. We're not told of the names or of the whereabouts of the wives of the first six kings of Israel. They're not mentioned. But when it comes to Ahab, we read, it's inserted here for our attention, he married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. And it would seem to me that this was highlighted because, one, she was the dominant partner in the marriage, and two, she was the one who initiated the Baal worship. Jezebel, I think, really ruled the kingdom. She was the power behind the throne. And when she came to that place and to that position, she brought her religious baggage, her religious history with her, the idolatrous worship of Baal. Baal, of course, was worshipped as the god of rain and of fertility, who controlled, if you like, the seasons and the crops and the land. And when Baal worship entered the kingdom of Israel, bringing its heathen practices and barbaric sacrifices, the wickedness in the land only increased. And it's into this context, it's into this setting that Elijah appears. J. Oswald Sanders writes, Elijah appeared at zero hour in Israel's history. Like a meteor, he flashed across the inky blackness of Israel's spiritual night. Nobody could have handled a couple like Ahab and Jezebel. The rugged and gaunt prophet from Tishbe became God's instrument of confrontation. And so first of all this morning, that is, if you like, the historical context into which Elijah was called. But I want to think more, I want to think a little more about Elijah himself. I mean, who was he? Where did Elijah come from? What was he like? The next thing I want to say to you, or you to note, is that the prophet's name. It's Elijah. Elijah. The Hebrew word for God in the Old Testament is Elohim, which is occasionally abbreviated El. The word Jah is, of course, the abbreviated version for the word Jehovah. And thus in Elijah's name we find the word for God and the word for Jehovah, or the word for God and the word for Lord. Between them is the small letter I, which in Hebrew has reference to the personal pronoun my or mine. And so putting these three together, what we find is that Elijah's name means my God is Jehovah. Or, the Lord is my God. Or even God is my Lord. Now think about that for a moment. Ahab and Jezebel were in control of the land. And Baal was the God they worshipped. But when Elijah burst onto this scene, his very name proclaims, I have one God. His name is Jehovah, and He is the one I serve and before whom I stand. Elijah. Secondly, it's worth noting here this morning where Elijah came from. You see, again in verse 1, what do we read? Now, Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, where did he come from? Well, he came from a place unknown. This guy, it seems, stepped out of nowhere. It's true, one scholar has said the term Tishbite refers to a native of a certain town by the name of Tishbe, or something similar to that. A site of this name has never been found, is unknown. Someone else has said, we can locate Gilead, but the town of Tishbe, or again something similar to that, is one of those places that the sands of time have completely hidden. And yet it's from that place, from this insignificant place, this unknown place, out of nowhere, Elijah comes and emerges as one of Israel's greatest heroes. Now then, historians tell us that Gilead, where Tishbe was located, it was a place of solitude and outdoor life. It's a place where people would have likely been rugged and tanned, you know, from the sun, muscular and leathery. It was never a place for polish or sophistication or diplomacy. Was an austere land, and one senses that Elijah's appearance was in keeping with that. His manner, coming from such a place, might have bordered on being a little bit coarse and maybe crude, rough and rugged. But it took a man just like that to meet Israel's darkest hour. An austere, solitary, rough and rugged man from the village of Tishbe. And the third thing to notice about Elijah is the way that he did things. You see, right from the start, you know, right from the outset, he's in the king's face. You know, it seems that without hesitation, with no apparent fear or reluctance, Elijah stands before King Ahab and comes straight to the point. No tiptoeing around it. You know, we used to say, no pussyfooting. But getting right down to business. Hey, remember, the kingdom of Israel had known 60 or more years of unbelief, assassinations, idolatry, ungodliness, and cutthroat rulers. Furthermore, the king and the queen presently reigning are the worst of the lot. Nevertheless, onto this stage steps a prophet from nowhere. He follows no protocol. He makes no introductions. He offers no royal deference to the royal presence. He is without sophistication, polish, training in courtly manners. He simply announces in verse 1, he says, as the Lord, the God of Israel lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word. Can you see him? Can you picture this? He's on a mission. He's declaring himself outright to be the servant of the Lord, the God of Israel. When all around him are evidences of evil and idolatry, that blatant Baal worship, without preparing his audience for the warning, he declares. He says, no rain, no dew. Your God is Baal, my God is Jehovah. No rain, no dew for years unless I say so. Baal or no Baal, folks, Elijah says, you're not getting any rain. And without rain, you don't have any crops. And without any crops, there is no food. And without no food, everybody dies. And no sooner is he there, having made the announcement, he's away again. He's gone. Elijah delivered the goods. He was a stand-in-the-gap messenger, uniquely anointed and used by God. He traveled solo, sounding the alarm, trying to awaken an indifferent and even hostile people. And you know what? God is looking for those men and those women. Those older men and women and those younger men and women who will do the same even today in our time. In our time. Men and women of courage. Men and women ready to stand and deliver the life-changing message of the good news of the Lord Jesus Christ. Men and women who will contend for the faith without compromise. Men and women who will proclaim and own the truth no matter what it costs. Men like Daniel. Women like Esther, who will stand in the gap, not a mediocre bone in their bodies, who will stand firm, who will stand tall, who will stand together and stand for what is right. Loved ones, listen. We lived, do we not, in a historical context that I was going to say, I've actually written this, that wants to redefine marriage. But that's wrong. That has already redefined marriage. We live in that historical context that allows millions, when we think on a world scale, millions upon millions of unborn babies to be murdered at an alarming rate. We live in that historical context that gives liberty to people who are aged and people who have ailments to take their own lives. We live in a historical context, of course, that encourages sexual immorality and activity outside of the context of marriage. And God is looking for Elijahs who will step onto those scenes and proclaim the word of the Lord. You know, in the book of Ezekiel, God has said, "And I searched for a man among them who should build up the wall and stand in the gap before me in the land, that I should not destroy it. But I found no one." And my prayer this week has been, oh, may he not be able to say that of us today, but rather find us as willing and faithful servants of his who are ready to do his work. Well, let me, as I bring this to a close this morning, let me just look at some lessons I think that we can learn from Elijah. First of all, we learn here, don't we, that God raises up and he uses ordinary people to do extraordinary things. See, we need to remember, don't we, and we do. But we just need to be reminded, don't we? We need to remember that Elijah was a guy just like us. He was made of the same stuff as us. Sometimes we look at these Bible characters and we think there was just something different about him. There was nothing different about him. He was a man just like us. That's what James writes over there in the New Testament, who was raised up by God at a very dark and difficult time. God needed a special man to shine in the light of the blackness of those days, and he used Elijah. He did not find someone, you know, he did not find Elijah in the palace or in the court. He didn't find him in the colleges or the universities of the day. He didn't find him in the school of the prophets. God found him at Tishbe of all places. God looked for somebody who had the backbone to stand alone. Someone who had the courage to step up and confront Ahab and Jezebel and say, that's wrong. This is wrong. Someone that can stand face to face with an idolater and proclaim, Baal is not God. God is God. Listen, in our culture, in our schools, and I look after four schools, and they're Church of England schools, in our offices, in our factories, in our lunchrooms, in our boardrooms, in our workshops, you know, in our grocery stores. We need men and women of God and young people of God. We need godly professionals, godly athletes, godly homemakers, godly teachers, godly public figures, and private citizens who will promote the things of God, who will stand alone, but will also stand together, standing tall, standing firm, and standing strong. This is the kind of person that God wants us all to be. God raises up and uses ordinary people like you, like me, to do extraordinary things. Secondly, we learn here that God's methods are often surprising. And they are, aren't they? You remember, won't you, that it was David's brothers who laughed at the thought of him standing against Goliath. They were the military men. They were the big men. David was a shepherd boy. And they laughed. What about Joshua walking around that city? Once a day, every day. People must have thought, what's he doing? What's he doing? And when it came to Ahab and Jezebel, God did not raise up an army to destroy them. Nor did he send some charming and wise prince to impress them. In fact, God sent the unimaginable when he sent the unknown and the rugged prophet Elijah. Of course, what we need to remember always is that God's ways and God's thoughts are not like ours. He knows all things and he knows best. And even though at times we don't know what he's doing or why he's doing it or the reason why he's doing it that particular way, we just got to know, don't we, that he knows what he's doing and he is in control of all things. Who would have thought? Who would have thought that God would have used a country preacher to bring Nicky Cruz to himself? I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, have read the book or you've heard the story. Nicky Cruz was a warlord of a vicious street gang called the Mamas. A gang leader whose smoldering rage inside of him found expression in violence, crime, and bloodshed. He was a twisted psychopath who frightened even his friends and was once told by a police psychiatrist that he was on a fast track to an electric chair. A guy you didn't mess with. A guy you didn't approach to talk to. And one day God sent a country preacher to New York. And he dared to proclaim the gospel to him. And incredibly and wonderfully, the gang leader surrendered his life to Christ. Listen, to me, God looks for and uses ordinary people like us to do extraordinary things. And God's ways are often surprising. As God, to use the language of the Bible, he chooses and uses the foolish, the weak, and the lonely to shame the wise, the strong, and the great in this world's eyes. Thirdly and finally, we learn here, don't we, that Elijah's God is our God and demands total allegiance to him. In other words, the idols have got to go. God must be number one in our lives. He must take center stage. He has got to be our one and only. It's true, isn't it? Idolatry must be confronted and purged from our lives. Gene Getz, in his book on Elijah, finishes chapter 1 by asking the question, do you have any foreign gods you should get rid of? Is there anything in your life that is consistently more important to you than God and His will? And he says, by example, you may be putting the car that you drive ahead of the God you claim to worship. Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? You put a car before the God that you worship, but it's true. You realize that your car has become your God. But it may not be your car, it may be something else. It could be your family. It could be your relationships. It could be your church. It could be your ministry. Your education. Your work, your career, your personal needs, your status, your position, your material possessions, including your technology, your recreational activities, be your television, your programs, your movies, your box sets, could be your leisure time. Could be your hobbies, and so on, and so on, and so on. Idolatry is sin, and must be dealt with in our lives and in our world today. Elijah teaches us these things. So let's be those. Let's be those who make the right choices. Let's be those who trust in the true and living God. Let's be those who walk, worship, and serve Him alone with all of our hearts and lives, just like Elijah did. Let's pray together.